Thank you so much, Shira, and thank you, everybody, for joining. As I said, it's lovely to see so many familiar faces and new faces and to learn with you once more. So thank you so much for the opportunity, Shira, and Rabbi Kelman, who's just here, and I'm glad to be here. And without further ado, let us delve into the Book of Judges, Sefer Shoftim. For those who are familiar with the book, it's often described as, well, I'll be blunt, somewhat depressing. Because this is, as we will see already today, a book about failure. The people are coming into the land of Israel with Joshua. They're conquering most of it, and we'll discuss that more at length in a little bit. And then there's this moment when it looks like a new era will begin. Like, here they are, sovereign in their own country, and it's the end of days. This is the promised future that they've been pursuing since before the exodus from Egypt, since Abraham and his Brit Ben Aptarim with God. And then instead of leading us to greater connection with God, to rising to the challenge of carrying the covenant in the land of Israel, to taking all the mitzvot, all the commandments that we were given in this desert that had to do with the land, with how we should live in the land, and applying them, instead of that, what we delve into is an era of anarchy, of constant wars against various other nations, some of them local, some of them invading, and sometimes even civil wars and uncivil relationships between the different tribes and within them. And furthermore, an era of alienation where families fall apart, or people are cruel or harsh to one another. Not exactly the promised future we were waiting for during the 40 years of this. And the truth is that the disappointment begins in the very first verses of the book. Here, I'll open the source sheet. I know that Shira posted it also in the chat for those who want it. Let us see the first verses of the book. After the death of Joshua, the Israelites inquired of the Lord, which of us shall be the first to go up against the Canaanites and attack them? And here I want to talk about the Hebrew, because the truth is that the translation doesn't quite capture the grandeur of this question. What we see here is the question that they're asking is, Mi ya'ale lanu? Who will rise for us? Batchila, at first. And this is a question that's ambiguously phrased. As Dr. Yael Ziegler explains in her book about Ruth, this is a question that could mean who should be our leader, who should go at the head of our camp, our joint camp as all the people of Israel, or it could mean who should fight their war of conquest first. Just to put it in context, In the time of Joshua, they conquered most of the land, but each of the tribes still has some area that's dedicated to them, but isn't conquered. And the question is, how are they supposed to go about conquering? And when we first hear the question, we don't know if what they mean is who should lead all of us or who should fight their war first. What we do know, and this is where the grandeur of the moment really shines through, is that this is the first time in the people's history as such, as a people, not as individuals, great individuals here and there. It's the first time in their history as a people that they initiate this kind of conversation with God. Let us compare it to the beginning of the book of Joshua, the previous book. I'm still in the first box, just the next source. After the death of Moses, a very similar opening to the opening in Judges that says after the death of Joshua, right? After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, son of Nun, Moshe's attendant, my servant Moshe is dead. Prepare to cross the Jordan together with all this people into the land that I am giving to the Israelites. The initiator of this conversation isn't Joshua. It is God. And the character of God's speech here isn't conversation as much as it is instruction, commandment. God makes an acknowledgement of Moshe's law, and he's conferring power to Joshua to lead the people. But the direction and the timing and the planning is all God's. This is very, very different from what we see in the source above it, when we see right here in the beginning of box one, after the death of Joshua, the Israelites inquired of the Lord. For the first time, they as a group come and ask God what they should do. And here we see a little bit of that promised future, where the people set their own course, where they are the authors of their future, all of them together, not one tribe or one leader, all of them as a collective are rising together, and it's clear that they have a desire and a will to do what they're supposed to do, which is to complete the war of conquest that God set them upon, and that they have the awareness that they shouldn't fight this war in disconnection from God's guidance. Because even though God doesn't initiate the conversation, they turn to God with a question. This, I think it's fair to say, sets a very strong expectation of this renaissance, of a golden era starting and opening right here, when the people will be the authors of their fate, where the people will take leadership position, where the people will work together in conversation with God. And all of these expectations that are thrumming, in a sense, through this first little verse are going to crush and burn. And it starts already in the very, very next two verses. I'm still in the first source. I'm reading in verse two. The Lord replied, "Let the tribe of Judah go up." In Hebrew, Ya'ale. "I now deliver the land into their hands." Judah then said to their brother tribe, Shimon, "Come up with us to our allotted territory and let us attack the Canaanites, and then we will go with you to your allotted territory." So Shimon joined them. And in this offer that Judah makes to the tribe of Shimon, we suddenly see that Judah interprets God's order in a very narrow, or Judah interprets the question, who shall rise up to the Canaanites, in a very narrow sense. Judah doesn't take it as their responsibility to lead the entire people to a war of conquest. They understand it as a literal statement of "you shall go first." And out of a strategic thinking, they offer Shimon a limited alliance to fight together. But what we understand from that is not just that they want to fight with Shimon. We also understand from that that they don't want to fight with anybody else, that they don't see their role as leaders. They see it as, in the sequence of events, we should take the first spot. Now, you may say that I'm reading a little bit too much into what is, after all, a very short paragraph. And furthermore, it could be that that's what God meant all along. God didn't specify, "I want you to lead the people, Judah." God said, "Ya'ale," shall rise up. It is only in our understanding of the language that we understand the ambiguity and the choice, the interpretive choice that the tribe of Judah is making. But this is a little bit, this is somewhat flimsy evidence if I want to convict Judah of irresponsibility. And if you were to say that, I would say that you are right. This in and of itself is not enough to condemn them. And yet it is setting a certain tone that the entire book is going to follow. The tone is one of what we call in Israel, Rosh Katan, small head. When presented with a role, with a challenge, with a future, making yourself small, not looking at the big picture, not going out of your way to take initiative, but rather doing the minimum possible. I would add another layer, and after all, this is a course that's really dedicated to family stories, and we will get to a family story very soon. But already here, we have, I think, a little bit of echoes of one of the big family stories of the Torah, by which I mean the family story of Joseph and his brothers, the family story we just finished reading about in Parshat Shavuot this week. Because note, and here I am indebted to my student Naomi Burstein for pointing it out to me a few years ago, note that it never says in the first verses of Shoftim, it never says the tribe of Judah, the tribe of Shimon. It just says Yehuda, Shimon. In verse 3, we see Judah then said to, and here it says their brother tribe Shimon, but this is an addition. What it says in the Hebrew is Vayomer Yehuda leShimon Achiv. Yehuda said to Shimon, his brother. It's almost as if at this great moment when we're supposed to see the people working as a collective, the language forces us to recall that before they were a collective of tribes, they were a group of brothers. And a group of brothers that it's hard to forget engaged in more strife between them than anything else in their early years. If you will look here, I brought in the second box, in the second page, in case you have it printed, the text of the sale of Joseph. What I want to highlight, we're not going to read the whole thing. What I want to highlight here is this feeling or this, it's not exactly feeling. It's this emphasis on the role of certain individual brothers. So I'm going to start from verse 21, actually. But when Reuven heard it, by which I mean he heard their plan to throw Joseph into a, by killing, to kill Joseph and throw him into one of the pits, he tried to save him, that is Joseph, from them. He said, let us not take his life. And Reuven went on, shed no blood, cast them into that pit out in the wilderness, but do not touch him yourself, intending to save him from them and restore him to his father. When Joseph came up to his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the ornamented tunic that he was wearing, and took him and cast him into the pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to a meal. Looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilad, their camels bearing gum, balm, and laudanum to be taken to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, what do we gain by killing your brother and covering up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, but let us not do away with him ourselves. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh. His brothers agreed. So already then, long ago, in that long ago moment between Yehuda and his brothers, we see that Yehuda takes a leadership position amongst the brothers, one that he takes upon himself, much as Reuven took a leadership position in convincing them not to kill Joseph in the first place. And also that Yehuda combines in his words an odd sense of brotherly concern. He says, he is our brother, we shouldn't spill his blood, with a very not brotherly suggestion of let us sell our brother. So when we suddenly are told of Yehuda talking to his brother Shimon in the beginning of Shoftim and making a deal with him to conquer land together, that essentially means by saying that he's making this deal with him, it implies that he's not making any similar overtures to any of the other brothers. He can't help but feel that, wait a minute, are we in a new story? Or are we reading the continuation of the same utilitarian, distant, strife-filled, conflict-filled relationship that started with the individuals, Shimon, Yehuda, Yosef, and now might play out on the national level? This might still remain in the land of conjecture, one could say. But what we see on the immediate factual level of the narrative is that this decision, the decision to fight separate wars of conquest instead of coming together and fighting under one leadership, has far-reaching consequences that reshape the entire history of the coming centuries after this moment. Because what happens is that instead of conquering the land as they're supposed to, the tribes failing one after the other to complete the conquest they are supposed to make. Let us look at the failure of the tribe of Judah. Judah is actually relatively successful, but since that's the tribe that was supposed to be the leader, let's start with them. I'm here in box one at the bottom source. The Lord was with Judah, so they took possession of the hill country, but they were not able to dispossess the inhabitants of the plain, for they had iron chariots. I would say here, as an aside, that this was true all around. In other words, the land of Israel has very clear geography. It has the ocean, right? Then the coastal plain, the hill country, the mountain range, and then the land drops down into the Jordan Valley. And time and again, we will see that the most secure place for the Israelite tribes was the mountain range. So the tribes that were lucky enough to have land in the mountains, namely Judah and Ephraim, did a relatively good job of conquering their land. The tribes that had the flat plain near the ocean, like Dan, for example, and we'll get to them quite a few weeks ahead, but Dan, for example, or the tribes that had the valley lands that crossed Israel from east to west in the north, like Israel, like Issachar, for example, weren't as fortunate, because the enemies fighting against them, the Canaanites, had enormous technological advantages. And while maybe if all the tribes had come together and fought as one, they might have been able to overcome those technological advantages, as they did in the days of Joshua, and as they will do in certain wars during the era of the Judges, one of which we'll discuss next week, fighting on their own, each chapter was incapable of withstanding the odds. I'll go back here to the tribe of Judah just a minute. They gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses had promised, and he drove the three Anakites out of there. Anakites as giants. The Benjamites did not dispossess the Jebusite inhabitants of Jerusalem. So the Jebusites have dwelt with the Benjaminites in Jerusalem to this day, namely to the end of the book of Judges, when the story is told. And this is just the beginning. The rest of almost the entire first chapter of Shoftim is a list of successful conquests and unsuccessful conquests, where the unsuccessful conquests become more and more and more and more prominent and take more and more space, showing us how, when they're not working together, when there's not one clear leadership for the people, that moment of initiative, that moment of the people asking about how they should conquer the land, clearly devoted to the task before them, fizzles under the pressure of failure. And one after another, the tribes reach various weird compromises with the nations around them. In some cases where they're more successful, they just allow little enclaves of Jebusites, Canaanites, Amorites, Perizzites amongst them. In other areas, like the Jezreel Valley up north, they become vassals of the Canaanite cities and pay them taxes, basically, to be allowed, or tribute in terms of the old world, ancient world, to be allowed to live there. And in some cases, as in the case of Shevet Dan, which, like I said, we'll come back to in a few weeks, They even have to leave the land that was allotted to them altogether and seek totally different land somewhere else. I saw a question in the chat. I'm not going to address questions in the chat in general until the end, but I'll just say, I saw a question in the chat about where Jerusalem is. Should Jerusalem be in the tribal land of Judah? So Jerusalem is actually on the border between Judah and Benjamin. And it's clear that the part of Jerusalem that existed at the time was on the Benjaminite side of the order. Just, we'll get to that another time. Let us continue. We saw how the expectation of conquest and unity fizzles. But with the fizzling of this expectation, what we see now is a chain reaction where all the other great expectations start faltering one after the other. The first, the disappointment, so to speak, is brought to the Israelites by God. God himself sees that they didn't follow through on what they promised to do. And he, in a sense, takes away their ability to fix reality. I'll explain after we read it in the text. Second, I am in page 3, box 3. An angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim. Bochim means cry. And said, I brought you up from Egypt. And I took you into the land which I had promised on oath to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And you, for your part, must make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You must tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed me. Look what you have done. Now, I want to pause here for a second and talk for a second about the logic of story. When a story starts with a certain promise, certain goal, and then the protagonists of the story fail and everything goes downhill and breaks up and someone comes and has a reckoning with them and tells them, you failed. You didn't do what you should have done. Let's imagine it's a Hollywood movie. We all know what's the next step, right? The next step is that they're all very downcast. All the protagonists are, you know, beating themselves up. And then they look deep inside and gather their strength and say, we're going to overcome it. We're going to make it work. We're going to win. And then they march and fix whatever it is they did wrong until now and fix everything together. This is how stories usually work. There's this glorious beginning, the fizzling, and then an act 2, regathering of strength and recommitting to the good fight. But this is not what's going to happen here because God wouldn't let him. Instead of following up on his rebuke by expressing some expectation that they should now try again and do better, God tells them that their very punishment, the punishment for what they just did, is that they wouldn't be able to complete the conquest moving forward. He says in verse 3, therefore, I have resolved not to drive them out before you. They shall become your oppressors and their gods shall be a snare for you. Instead of allowing the people to recapture their momentum and grasp the promised reality that they were supposed to grasp from the get-go, God is changing the plan. He's changing the terms of the covenant. The terms of the covenant moving forward are, they're going to have to work much harder because instead of having a land that's wholly theirs and that they're sovereign and that they control and manage as they see fit, what they're going to be facing is a country where they have partial control, where they're surrounded by other nations who sometimes lives amidst them, and where they constantly have to struggle not simply against the military and political threat that these people represent, but also against the temptation to adopt their ways, to worship their gods, to forget and abandon their covenant with God altogether. This may seem odd. Why should God choose to punish them in this way? And yet, while not becoming less odd, I think it becomes more understandable if we look at it in the context of God's general management of the world and management of great disappointments throughout biblical history. If you think about it, when Adam and Eve eat from the fruit, God doesn't give them a second chance. Reality changes underneath them. They no longer live in Eden. They no longer have childbearing and fruit bearing from the ground coming easily to them. Now they have to live with the consequences of their choice. When the Israelites worship the calf, God does give them the second tablets, but there are consequences for this sin that pursue us throughout history. there is a beautiful midrash that says that if it wasn't for Chetah Egel, everything would have been much faster and we would have reached the full Geula within one generation. The second, they're no longer there fully with their hearts, and God says, okay, so we're going back to a reality where you're not ready, where you're struggling, and this is going to be your reality. And most famously, in the moment when they send out the spies from the desert to the land of Israel, and the spies come back with fear-mongering stories about the giants of the land and how terrible it is, etc., etc. Well, God technically forgives the people. He doesn't destroy all the people when they lose heart and say they don't want to go to the land of Israel. He doesn't allow them to take back their resignation not to go to Israel. He tells them that just as they asked, they said, we would rather die in the desert than go to the land of Israel. He says, okay, your generation shall die in the desert and your children shall go to the promised land. And the next day, when a group of people says, no, 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 we are repentant. We are going to go. We are going to go to the land of Israel. You shall not dissuade us. We will do what God wanted from us. God doesn't protect them from the consequences of their choices. And the people they meet on the way slaughter them. Because pushing forward, once God said you can't push forward, is the same kind of mistake as not pushing forward when God said to yes, push forward. And here in Shoftim, we see the same repetitive pattern. Once they reshaped reality, God isn't going to just let them ignore that. God isn't going to help them swipe it off the table. They are now going to have to live in the reality they shaped for themselves, a reality where they're not a sovereign nation all alone in the land. And perhaps not very surprisingly, the idols that God tells them will serve as snares for them, as a constant test of faith, indeed snared them. And we see that in the following verses in the book. I am still in box 3. I'm going to read this source. When Joshua dismissed the people, here we go a little bit back. Joshua's life, but we will see why it's important in a second. The Israelites went to their allotted territories and took possession of the land, which we already know that they didn't do fully. The people served the Lord during the lifetime of Joshua and the lifetime of the older people who lived on after Joshua and who had witnessed all the marvelous deeds that the Lord had wrought for Israel. In other words, the generation that conquered the land. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years and was buried on his own property at Timnath Cheres in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. And all the generation were likewise gathered to their fathers. Another generation arose after them, which had not experienced the deliverance of the Lord or the deeds that he had wrought to Israel. This is a somewhat clumsy translation, because what it actually says in the Hebrew is, "Vayakam dor acher achrehem, asher lo yad'u et Hashem." They did not know God. Damning words that echo the description of Paro in the beginning of the book of Exodus, where we are told that a new Paro rose who didn't know Joseph. So this generation is described in words that evoke the horrific ingratitude that allowed Paro to betray the memory of Joseph, the man who saved all of Egypt, and enslave his descendants. And here we see that a generation rises who does not know God and what God had done to us, and there, and the following, what follows out of their lack of memory in verse 11, and the Israelites did what was offensive to the Lord. They worshipped the Baalim. In Hebrew, ve'ya'avdu et ha'Baalim. They became enslaved. They slaved for the Baalim. Baalim, the idols of Israel. The idols of Israel. Sorry. This moment of loss of memory sets in motion what is known as the cycle of the book of Shoftim. I didn't bring here the source that describes it because I do want to get to the family story, I promised in the title. But the cycle that repeats itself over and over and over again throughout the era is one where a generation forgets God and forgets with God and the memory of the miracles and aid God gave us. They also forget their debt to God. They abandon the covenant. They ovdim et habalim, worship the Baalim. And as a response, God removes his protections from them and allows them to become enslaved and oppressed by the nations fighting around them. There's this beautiful connection in the language between la'avod et habalim and la'avod et hamelachim. They, just as they enslave themselves through their worship to the idols of these people, then they become slaves to the people themselves. I think there's a very deep truth here about the psychological integrity of the self. That if we allow ourselves to adopt the beliefs of other people, on some level, we already made ourselves open to being taken over and absorbed by them, to making ourselves subservient to them. And time again, what follows is that the people are suffering under the oppression of some invading nation or a local nation taking over them, call out to God, and God in his grace sends a shofet, a military leader, to save them. There's a moment of salvation. The moment of salvation restores the memory of the people's debt to God. And then, in most of the stories, we will see some exceptions in coming weeks, during the lifetime of that judge and of these people who went through the salvation, the people worship God properly. But then as soon as the judge dies and the generation dies out, the same loss of memory that's accompanied by a loss of commitment to the covenant plagues them again. And the whole cycle begins anew. In the coming weeks, we will see several repetitions of these cycles, and we will see that while, yes, it is depressing in a sense to see this repetition, there are things that change. Not every repetition ends in the same way. Not everyone teaches the same message. Before we can go there, before we even enter this more, you know, substantive part of the book of Judges, I want to note that amidst all this discussion of the sins of not coming together, not working, not showing leadership in the case of Judah, not conquering the land, and worshiping Avodah Zarah, within that text, within those two chapters that set in motion these events, present to us the dream of what could have been and the crashing reality of where it's going instead, hides an anecdote about a particular conquest that seems out of place in two different ways. Let us see it together. Here is the anecdote in the book of Judges 1, verses 12 to 15, box 4. And Caleb, who was the leader of Judah tribe, announced, I will give my daughter Achsa in marriage to the man who attacks and captures Kiryat Sefer, one of the big cities in the land that Judah is supposed to conquer. His younger kinsman, Otniel the Kenizzite, the rabbis explained that he was his half-brother from a different mother, captured it, or a different father, sorry. And Caleb gave him his daughter Achsa in marriage. When she came to him, that is to Otniel, her new husband, she induced him. In Hebrew, it's a stronger word. It's vatesiteu. It's almost like she agitated for him to do something, to ask her father for some property. Hasadeh in Hebrew, the field. She dismounted from her donkey and Caleb asked her, what is the matter? She replied, give me a present. It's interesting. In Hebrew, it doesn't say present. It says bracha, blessing. For you have given me away as negev, you've given me, you've natatali, negev land. That is the land of the desert. Give me springs of water. And Caleb gave her upper and lower gulot. In other words, he gave her, it's kind of ambiguous here, but it seems that what it means is that he gave her a place. We actually know where it is, or at least we have a good guess about where it is, that has two sets of freshwater springs, one higher on the mountain, one lower in the mountain, gulot ilit and gulot ti, two sets of springs, since the rest of the land that he allotted to her and her husband is dry desert. Now, this episode is odd on two counts. First and foremost, why do we care? We started this book with the sense of we're going to be talking about a national war of conquest. Here the people are coming together and asking God a question, and then they're going to fight wars. So it should be, you know, what it evokes in us is this expectation that this is going to be about national wars, conquest, leadership, big macro history questions. Why do we care about this micro history and one family's dispute, or not even dispute, one family's situation where one brother is giving his other brother his daughter as wife, and then she's not happy with the land she got and has to ask for more? Why do we care? Even more so, why do we care to hear about it in such detail? All of this could have been said like this. And Caleb said, whoever captures Kiryat Sefer gets my daughter. His younger kinsmen capture it. Caleb gave him his daughter Achsa, and he gave the happy couple this and this piece of land, plus these and these streams. Why do we need to understand that at first he only gave them land without water, but then it was his daughter who started agitating to get the water springs? Why do we care that first she agitated her husband to ask, right? She first says, induced him to ask her father for some property. But then instead of letting him actually follow through on it, she dismounts from the donkey and asks for it directly. Why do we care? Why is it important? And in case these questions are not enough, there's another oddity about this anecdote. And the oddity is that it's out of place. We already heard pretty much exactly this episode. You can see it here. I'm not going to bore you by reading the same story precisely. Excuse me. In chapter 15 of Joshua, we saw exactly the same story. Furthermore, we know that Caleb belonged to Joshua's generation. In other words, this whole story happens during Joshua's lifetime. Why is it mentioned in the beginning of the book of Judges in the story of the conquests that follow after Joshua's death? In other words, why do we need such a detailed story? And even if we need it, why do we need it here and now? And to answer this question, I want to take a step back and talk for a minute about the role of families in the book of Judges. I called the title of this course draws attention to the issue of families, of homes. Because what we will see, and every week we're going to visit a different family, is that throughout this book that starts as this macro history, national, military, leadership history, despite the emphasis on warfare, on generals leading people in arms, etc., time and time again, the biblical storyteller places families and family relationships front and center. And I think that the message here is extremely important because it's more than just showing us how geopolitical reality affects families or how the families of leaders affect national events, both of which are true to this day, true facts, true aspects of reality. In a sense, it's almost as if the book wants us to pay attention to these family relationships because within them, we can find the keys both for our failure as a people in the book of Judges, but more importantly, for the road or the right path to redemption. Because time and time again, if we pay attention to these families, to their failings and their successes, we can gain an understanding of how the era of the judges can be outpaced, how the curse of God, the curse that says you will not defeat these people and you will be ensnared by them, can become not a depressing end of the erstwhile impressive and promising story, but rather the springboard for a new chapter, the chapter that will come in the later books in Ruth, Shmuel, and Malachim. And we see that already in this little anecdote that places family relationships at the heart of the stories of conquest of the first chapter of Judges. But in order to see what the story means or what key it gives us, we should remind ourselves that water in Torah sometimes means water, but sometimes it means something other entirely. And to unravel what it means, I want to read a text from the book of Exodus. It's a piece that follows, it's a piece of the narrative that follows directly after the parting of the sea. After everybody saw God's hand on the ocean, after everybody sang together, thanks to God, this great moment of elation. And then it's followed by the following text. I'm here in box 5. Then Moses caused Israel to set out from the Sea of Reeds. They went on into the wilderness of Shur. They traveled 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. They came to Marah, but they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. Marah literally means bitter in Hebrew. That is why it was named Marah. And the people grumbled against Moshe, saying, "What shall we drink?" So he cried out to Hashem, and Hashem showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. There God made for them a fixed rule. There they were put to the test. God said, "If you will heed your God diligently, doing what is upright in God's sight, giving ears to God's commandments and keeping all of God's laws, then I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that I brought upon the Egyptians, for I am Hashem, your healer." There's an obvious problem in the text that emerges in verse 26. And the problem is that God's speech seems completely unrelated to the course of events that prompted it. Here come the people and say, "We don't have water." Here comes God and gives them water. And then we might expect that he would make some sort of speech along the lines of, "You know, if you have faith in me, I will always provide you water and food. Or if you believe in me, I will protect you from thirst and suffering." Instead, he says, "If you listen to my commandment, I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that I brought upon Egypt." But who was talking about that? They were not talking about disease. They were talking about thirst. What has that to do with anything? So following this question, the Midrash and some of the traditional Rishonim interpreters, Rashi amongst them, say that this whole story, in a sense, is just a cover. It's just an outer layer of a much, much deeper conversation going on. And they say that the people's grumbling about water were merely an expression of a deeper thirst, the thirst for guidance. Here they are, no longer slaves, marching out of Egypt, and they don't know what to do. God tells them, "March this way." Great, they're marching this way. But what else are they supposed to do when it's nighttime and they're setting their tents? How are they supposed to know where to set their tents? Who should get which allotment? How should they manage property? How should they manage disputes between families or within families? Until now, they were slaves, and it was terrible, but they knew what to expect. They knew what the rules of their reality was. Here they are between Egypt and before Sinai, and they have no idea what they're doing. And so they're grumbling, and they're anxious. And according to the Midrash, what God gives them here is not just water. What God gives them is a fixed rule, chok u'mishpat. God gives them basic rules about how to manage And here the commentators split a little bit. Some say some basic halachot of following God. Some say basic rules about how to manage within a social situations. Either way, God is giving them a little bit of guidance. And then his speech makes much more sense when he says, if you listen to these commandments, I will protect you from the troubles I caused to Egypt. This is only one case out of many in Torah, where, as the sages say, we see that water is a stand-in, a metaphor for Torah, for guidance, for God offering us commandments or guidance of any sort as to what we're supposed to be doing. And once we hold this metaphor in mind, the entire conversation between Achsa and her father takes an entirely different character. Let's go back to that text. I'm still here on the same page, page 4 in the fourth box. What we see here is a father who helps his daughter settle into a new home. He marries her, who gives her the physical means, the basic physical means to live in her new home. And now she comes to him and says, this is not enough. This is not enough. I also need water. Now, in her particular case, it seems that she literally needs water. But if we look at Tachsa as a symbol or as a stand-in or a representative of her generation, the generation that didn't see the miracles of the Exodus, the generation that will continue Jewish history past this moment of Joshua's death and the death of his generation. If we look at her as a representative of the children, when she comes to her father and says, you need to give me more than land, what she's really saying is, you need to give us guidance. It's your responsibility, father. It's your generation's responsibility to give us the tools to preserve our life as a people. Water is life. And the way to preserve it is Torah, is a connection, a guidance that connects us with God. And if we understand this to be her request, what we hear later about the loss of memory, about the rise of a generation that lost the memory of what God did for us, and therefore lost the memory of their responsibility to uphold our side of the covenant with God, we realize that what we see here is not just a matter of forgetfulness. What we see here is an educational failure. It's a case of one generation giving the next generation life in the physical sense, land in the physical sense, but not giving them the guidance, the knowledge that will enliven it and allow them to continue the Jewish path. I'll add another layer to this in a sense that helps us put this in focus. Moshe himself is very aware of the danger of forgetfulness. Moshe spends the last month before his death in a series of speeches, which later become the book of Deuteronomy, Dvarim. Isn't it beautiful that the man who started his career as Ish Kved Dvarim, a person who's not a man of words, giving us all these speeches and words before his death. And what he says over and over again in the book of Dvarim is that, guys, if you forget that God is the one who took you out of Egypt, if you forget what you owe him and stop following the covenant and start worshiping the gods of the nation amongst which you're about to live, God will also withdraw his side of the covenant and you will suffer. You will be oppressed. You will be exiled. In other words, he's telling them exactly what we're about to see happening throughout the book of Shoftim. And time again, he offers them a way to avoid it, a tool to stop themselves from reaching that future, which, as we see, they did in fact reach despite these warnings. And the tool lies in the relationship between parents and children. Let's look here in box 6, in Deuteronomy 4, verse 9. But take utmost care and watch yourself scrupulously, so that you do not forget the things that you saw with your own eyes, and so that they do not fade from your mind as long as you live. And make them known to your children and to your children's children. In other words, it's your responsibility to pass it on. The generation of Kalev is responsible to pass it on.
But in quite a few places, Moshe says, or Moshe implies, that the way to pass it on is not to go and force it on the next generation, but rather to wait for those moments when they ask. For example, just a moment. I'm in the third source in that box. Deuteronomy 6. When, in time to come, your children ask you, what mean the decrees, laws, and rules that our God Hashem has joined upon you? You shall say to your children, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and Hashem freed us from Egypt with a mighty hand. It'll be on us, on every generation, to wait for those openings in our children's heart and in their curiosity, and give them the knowledge that will, the water, the Torah, that will allow them to continue the story. So when Caleb's daughter comes to him and says, give me water, and he gives her water, they are modeling for all of us what should have been the future of the Jewish people. What on a generational level would have guaranteed that the momentum of the beginning of the book of Joshua, the very first verse, would have carried through. And what we will see instead as we go through the book is that the children don't listen to the parents. The parents don't talk to the children. When they do, they sabotage each other. And that method or that model of the children asking for life, for water, for guidance, and the parents providing it and keeping them within the covenant fails us time and time again. Now, there's one last point I want to make about the story of Achsa and how it relates to the rest of the book. Before that, I'll take a few questions from the chat. We have to finish in a few minutes, so I'm not going to have time to answer everything. Just a minute. Dennis Karp wrote, Jewish leadership requires going out in front like a shepherd to inspire and galvanize the people, but not too far in front. Dennis, would you like to elaborate what you mean by this? I don't know if you're still here.
Yes, I'm still here. What it is leaders must understand where the community is in order to lead. If a leader has a vision but is too far ahead both physically and spiritually, he will lose his people. But at the same token, if he isn't enmeshed in the problems of the community about forgetting the covenant, then he can't or she cannot lead. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem is not having that nuanced leadership throughout the shop team, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. And this is going, the question of leadership and what's good leadership and how exactly to do it is going to really haunt us throughout the book. So I'm not going to address it more than that now because we will see it many times, but thank you. This is a good observation. I will share one more thing from the questions here. iPad wrote, in Canaan, there really are multiple fifth columns. The worry of the Egyptians about their growing in numbers, Hebrew slaves. You're right. It's an interesting, if I understand correctly, the comparison you're making is that Paro was concerned about the Israelite slaves, the Israelites before they were slaves in Egypt. And then the Israelites are concerned about the other nations living amongst them. It's an interesting comparison and definitely an astute one. And I think it's a comparison that, you know, in our postmodern, very liberal world, it's uncomfortable to think about, but the truth is every country has immigration laws, and immigration laws often have to do exactly with that, with how do you keep the integrity of a society while allowing new elements to come in. So God's solution in the book of Joshua is not to let them in and make of it what you will. And iPad made another comment that I think is worth sharing, that Caleb lived his life, his most important part of his life as a slave. And then in the desert, maybe springs were not so important for him while land was. And I think what you're really kind of cutting straight to the heart here is that every generation experiences the challenges before them differently. Caleb's generation experienced what it is not to have land, what it is not to have a place of your own. But the reality of living in a land, of having to manage it, is something that their children are going to have a much stronger grasp of. And perhaps that difference, the difference between how each generation experiences their reality, helps us understand how this chronic forgetfulness or chronic failure to pass information and guidance from generation to generation is about to happen. I don't have time, unfortunately, to address the other questions now. I appreciate all of them. Unfortunately, I don't have time, but I do want to make one more comment, and with that, round up today's class. It's worth noting that it's not a son asking his father for water. In other words, in this story, the husband could have asked for water, right? At first, it seems that Achsa wants Otniel to be the one who speaks to Kalev, her father, his brother, and asks for water. But then she steps forward and does it herself. And in that, she becomes the first of a long row, I could say, or a long line of women that take initiative in surprising ways throughout the book of Shoftim. And in many ways, it already hints to us a little bit to the solution. And I want to finish on that note instead of on the depressing note of, oh no, look at the horrible era we're entering, an era of not passing on the right things. The happy note or the encouraging note is that God, while allowing all these nations to take over us, is not abandoning us. God is trying to remind us throughout the book of himself, of his place in our salvation. God tries to help us remember or fix the problem of memory that made us stray from him. And he does so by saving us in surprising ways that subvert expectations and awaken the people to the fact that there's someone behind the scenes moving things along. And one of the ways he does it is by working through women, as we will see at length next week when we're going to talk about three women, two homes, and a grand war that Dvorah initiates for the people. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to seeing you next week, and have a lovely, lovely.